بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله وسلم وبارك على سيدنا ومولانا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم. اللهم علمنا ما ينفعنا، وانفعنا بما علمتنا، وزدنا من فضلك علما وتعليما، إنك على كل شيء قدير. وبعد، السلام عليكم. الحمد لله. This is our final class in module 9. Module 9 has all been about the halal and the haram, which is mostly about the haram, because the default is everything is halal, except for the specific things forbidden by Allah Ta'ala and His Messenger Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, or the things that resemble them close enough to where they are joined by qiyas. And we were talking about the halal and haram matters of consumption in the last two classes. And this final class is basically the conclusion to the issue of consumption, where we talk about miscellaneous issues. And maybe if there's time left over, we can open the floor for any general questions and answers, because there were a lot of questions last week when we touched on the issue of meat, the conditions of a proper slaughter, and that perennial question, can I eat a Chick-fil-A? And things like that. So there's no particular order to the issues today. So we're looking at a few miscellaneous issues, a few questions that are related to what we talked about last week. And in addition to that, we'll be talking about the issue of drugs, alcohol, byproducts, not so much alcohol, because we all know that's haram, and the issue of smoking and tobacco products and stuff like that. So we'll begin with the issue of utensils, awani. One of these things I remember hearing many, many years ago as a new Muslim was, whenever you order a pizza, there's one thing you should always ask them to do: to not cut it or use a new pizza cutter. So this is one issue, and this is grouped in the issue of awani, or utensils, in the books of fiqh. So we'll go to that issue first. Now, utensils, the ulama say, are two types. There are the utensils used exclusively by Muslims, and there are utensils used by non-Muslims. Now, those non-Muslims may be using them for things that are, for us, haram or impure, or maybe they're not. It all depends. So because of this, the fuqaha mentioned that there are, when you look at the utensils used by non-Muslims, there's two types. There's the utensil or utensils that are used for the consumption or of haram foods or impure foods, and utensils that are not used for haram foods or impure things. And they say that the utensils that are not used for impure or haram substances, they're permissible to use. So there's no issue there. Doesn't matter if it's a Muslim using the utensil or not, or non-Muslim. But if the utensils are used for haram or impure substances, they can be used, but they have to be washed, but it's still disliked to use them if other utensils are available. So you see the picture here of the pizza, because that's the immediate issue that comes to mind when you think about this matter. What it means is, very simply, have them leave the pizza uncut, and if that's not possible, tell them, if you want it cut, to use something that's been washed. It's very simple. That's all. Then we move on. So the question, I forget who asked it. I think it was Brother Khalid. You asked last week about rennet, right? So the rennet issue is an issue that comes up in these discussions about halal and haram food products. You have a lot of Muslims who are going to grocery stores and looking at the cheeses and wondering, can I eat this cheese? Is it halal? Is it haram? And the reason why they question that is because of the issue of rennet. And the question is that rennet halal or haram to eat? What is it? And this is a topic that the fuqaha did discuss in some detail in the past. And there were, as you can imagine, two views. One view was that the rinit would be a prohibited impure substance if it's not from a properly sourced animal. And the other view is that because it's not meat as such, it will be permissible to use. So I'm going to reference the Hanafi school in this matter. And in the Hanafi school, they say that rinit that is obtained from an animal slaughtered by a non-Muslim or a Muslim, whether done properly or not properly, in any case, that rinit is halal to eat as long as the animal is not a pig. So rinit, or rinin as an enzyme, is used in the food industry for making cheese by curdling milk. And the lawfulness of the rinit does not depend on whether the animal from which it's obtained has been slaughtered properly or not, or whether it was slaughtered by a Muslim or a non-Muslim. What matters here is whether that thing has life in it or not. So the fuqaha say that the circulation of blood within an organ is the cause of life for the animal, but there's no blood flowing through the rinit. So it's obtained from an animal, but it's not actually a living thing. It can't die, so therefore you can consume it. And there's a hadith that speaks about the use of rinit or consuming cheese. And this comes from Abdullah ibn Umar radiallahu anhuma. And he mentions that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam was brought cheese during the Battle of Tabuk. And he asked for a knife, said Bismillah, and he cut the cheese. He sliced this cheese and ate it. And there's no question about the source. What did it come from, a Muslim or a non-Muslim? And this is in Tabuk. So this means that the cheese would have been produced in the north, which was a predominantly Christian area. So there's no question about the source. He said Bismillah and he ate from it. So what this means is that you can basically eat cheese as long as the ingredients don't have any animal byproducts like pork, or the rennet is not from pork, and the rennet isn't from pork, by the way. So basically, you can eat that cheese. Some of the fuqaha, though, they do say that it's better to avoid if the source is unknown, because not because it's prohibited, but because there is that classical difference of opinion about the origin and whether or not you have to consider its source or not. So, I mean, if you want to take that strict view, you can avoid cheeses unless you can ascertain the source of the rinit by calling the manufacturer or finding out. Otherwise, you can get any ordinary cheese and you don't have to worry about any of those things. So that's on the issue of rinit. Moving along, we have the issue of food cooked with alcohol or food that has alcohol byproducts. So there's two different issues here. And this actually harkens back to a question that I was asked, I don't know, maybe last year or the year before, in the Ask the Imam class, or the session we have once a month. The questioner asked about eating food that is prepared with alcohol. So we want to make a distinction between foods that might have some chemical in the ingredients that is an alcohol base and is used in the manufacture of an end product, versus cooking food with alcohol for the flavoring, right? In some cuisines, they'll pour wine into the food because it tenderizes the meat and it gives the food a very specific flavor that people are after. So these are two different issues here. Now, Islamically speaking, alcohol, khamr, is najisa. It is, and najisa here means it's impure, both spiritually speaking, because it's haram to consume, and it's also physically impure. And this is according to all four schools. This means that if someone were to spill beer or wine on their hand or on their clothing, that is najasa that has to be removed before you can pray. So physically speaking, it is najasa. And spiritually speaking, it's a kind of najasa too, because it is haram for a person to consume. So if the dish is cooked with alcohol and the alcohol evaporates, the flavor of the alcohol remains. So it's still impure. And you can't say that it's undergone the istihala, that total chemical change where it's a different thing altogether. Why? Because you can still taste it. You can taste that alcohol in the cooking. Therefore, you cannot eat foods that are prepared with alcohol if they retain the flavor like that. And we should not eat those kinds of foods at all. And usually those establishments are also selling alcohol and they're just permeated with khamar everywhere. And most Muslims, alhamdulillah, they avoid those kinds of things. But what Muslims often encounter are foods that have certain alcohol or ingredients that are sourced from alcohol. And they have been used in the preparation of something. The flavor is not there. It's undergone a very substantive change. And they wonder, can I eat this thing or can I not? If the food is flavored, or if the ingredients of a dish comes from what we call synthetic alcohol, synthetic alcohol, as opposed to wine or whiskey or beer, right? If it's a synthetic alcohol that is used in the preparation of the food, it is precautionary. It is better to avoid those things. However, at least in the Hanafi school, there's actually leeway here. There is some leeway. And that is because in the Hanafi view, synthetic alcohols and other alcohols that are not derived from dates or grapes are tahir. They're ritually pure. They're not najis. And therefore, because they're not impure, they can be used, but with some conditions. So I can't actually think of a dish right now or a food product that would have that kind of synthetic alcohol. Nothing comes to mind. Does anything come to mind? Almond extract? Or vanilla extract? Yeah, vanilla. That's a good one, actually. So vanilla extract. So according to the Hanafi school, that's a synthetic alcohol that is added to the vanilla. And according to the Hanafi school, because it's not from dates or grapes, it is still tahir. It's still ritually pure. And if it is added to a substance like this vanilla extract, it can be used. As long as it's not used as an intoxicant, and I don't imagine anyone drinking buckets of vanilla extract to get drunk. If they did that, it would be haram. But if it's this small amount that you're putting in cooking, it's synthetic, it's tahir, therefore, and it's not used as an intoxicant, it will be halal. And it is not, if it's not used as intoxicants are used, again, you know, drinking, right? Mimicking, you know, how someone would drink wine, for instance. And likewise, it cannot be used in an amount that would normally intoxicate. And that's really difficult because most of these products that have some synthetic alcohol, for you to get intoxicated by them, you would probably end up in the hospital anyway, and not due to the intoxication, but just due to the sheer amount of whatever it is you take. And when you look at these products, you find the alcohol level is 5% or even less. And sometimes if it's less than that, they won't even list those ingredients. They won't even list it if it's less than 5%. So you wouldn't even know. So as long as these conditions are met, they say it's not used in lehu, and here it means it's not something that's done where you're imitating wine drinking and all of that, then you can use those things. There's no problem with that at all. And the ulama say that the reason why this appears as a kind of exception to the rule is that there is a basic need, right? We don't say darura, we don't say a necessity. We say haja, right? It's a haja for general dishes that people cook in that society, the general need for certain ingredients. if some of these ingredients happen to have synthetic alcohol from things that are not derived from dates or grapes, then one could use it. Also, they say because of umum al-balwa. And umum al-balwa means it's so widespread, it's so prevalent, that it's actually difficult to avoid. It's actually difficult to avoid. This means that if you get the vanilla extract, you don't have to worry. If you get this or that product and it has that small percentage of something synthetic, according to the Hanafi school, you are not consuming khamar, which is prohibited. So you are not involved in the haram, inshallah ta'ala. Khair. Next question, or the next issue that comes up, and this is related to our class last week, is eating a food item that you're not sure, is it halal, is it haram? You're not sure about the origin of it. And can you trust restaurants that put the label halal? All right, so there's two issues here. Now, the default assumption about food is that it's tahir. That is your operative principle. The default is that foods are tahir, they're pure. Your default assumption is not that all foods are najis, impure, and haram until proven otherwise. The default is that the food is tahir, it's pure, until it is established that it is impure. So, for this reason, you assume that foods are halal. Of course, meat is the exception here. You have to know or be reasonably certain that the meat is halal, right? The default assumption about meat is that it's haram until established that it's halal. And that leads us to the second issue, which is how much can you trust restaurants or establishments that say they're selling halal food, halal meat? How much do you have to investigate, right? And now in the Muslim community in North America, both in Canada as well as United States, you have these different halal monitoring authorities. And, you know, some of them are better than others, both in how stringent they are as well as how ethical they are, because it's also a money-making endeavor for them too, even though they are providing a service. So if you go to a restaurant and it says, oh, this is, we always sell is halal, it's all halal, can you just trust them and take their word? Or do you have to go investigate and ask them, well, who's your supplier? And I need to know who they are, and are you certified? What do you need to do? The problem is, the default is that a Muslim is trustworthy. But we all know that that's not always the case. There are Muslims who cut corners. In one Muslim country, they did a study and they found that 20% of the meat products were contaminated with donkey meat. People cutting corners. So it's one thing to know the default that Muslims are, you know, the person is trustworthy, you take them at their word. It's another thing to know the way things operate, and so maybe you're distrustful. So in this case, maybe find out, are there any local scholars who know about that restaurant and where they're getting the meat from? Do they trust them or do they not trust them? Are these Muslims running the establishment God-fearing Muslims, or are they just, you know, Muslims, salamu alaykum, mashallah, but in terms of taqwa, there's not much. If you know them, you see them at the masjid, they pray, they're generally upright people, you can trust them. And inshallah, they're doing the right thing, right? That's all you have to do. The meat is lawful since the seller is a Muslim, and everything is halal until proven otherwise because you're taking them at their word. But if you have reliable sources which tell you that, yeah, they're not getting their meat from a halal source, they're just pulling the wool over people's eyes and labeling it halal when it's not, or if they are very open in their fisq, their moral corruption. They don't do certain things. They're very open in sinfulness. You can pause and reconsider and maybe purchase your meat from somewhere else. But if you do exercise basic due diligence, then inshallah, you're okay. If it turns out that they cheated you, that is between them and Allah, right? I know in some places, some of the mashayikh would say, don't buy your meat from someone who doesn't pray. If they don't pray, don't buy your meat from them. Why? Not because that is a rule in Sharia, but their argument was that if this person is not praying, they don't have the bare minimum taqwa to establish the most important fard action, then what's to say they're not going to cut corners with other things, right? So buy your meat, frequent restaurants from those who are generally practicing Muslims to the best of your ability. And if you feel doubt, you feel uneasy, you get bad vibes, go somewhere else. But if you try your best and it turns out they were cheating you, and you tried your best, that's on them. And you're not blameworthy, inshallah. Another question that comes up with regards to meat is the issue of what are the etiquettes regarding questioning Muslims about their meat. Someone invites you to their house, you come in, you take off your shoes and your coat, you sit down, you're entertained for a while, and then they bring out the dinner. Is it proper for you to say, brother, is this halal? Where did you get your meat from? Tell me your supplier. Is this proper? Well, the classic works of Islamic law, they say that you don't need to ask when someone is serving you meat at their house. It is against adab, good manners, to interrogate them about the origin of their meat. It's disrespectful because it's operating on the assumption that they're possibly serving you haram. And if you want to make someone angry, insinuate that they're serving you haram when they're very strict about avoiding haram foods. That will get them angry. It's bad adab. So the ulama, they say, you shouldn't ask, don't inquire, bad adab. However, I think it's also important that we contextualize those statements. Those ulama who said, don't question Muslims about their meat, are saying this in a time and in an environment where Muslims were the supermajority, where halal was the default, where the meat was slaughtered by Muslims, right? Because everyone is a Muslim. And there's a basic level of religious observance. So for you to question someone in that context, it definitely is bad adab. But sometimes you may know the person gets their meat from the supermarket. And maybe you take the stricter view. Last week we talked about this issue, that you have the stricter view, which we said if you're adhering to the principles of the Hanafi school in this issue, the supermarket meat is out of the question. If you are adhering to the principles within the Shafi'i school on meat issues, the supermarket meat is out of the question. So let's say you take that stricter view where you're never going to touch meat except the meat that is killed by a Muslim in a halal setup. But you know your host takes the other opinion, right? If you feel strongly about the opinion you're holding to, and you know they take the other opinion, you're not going to condemn them for taking that view. But you also know that that's what they follow. Do you just eat it? Or do you question them? Or what do? This is where it gets a little complicated, because you don't want to offend them. But if you know that they get their meat from the supermarket, some of their ulama say that if that is the case, you know, you should perhaps reach out to them and say, you know, I take this stricter view, so I'm honored that you have invited me, and I just want to let you know that I do have this stricter view. So, yeah, you know, it's either vegetarian night meatless Monday, or, you know, maybe you can go and actually get some meat that's from the halal shop or wherever. And that way you're comfortable and he's comfortable. You haven't offended the person, hopefully. But, you know, that's the basic way you could do it. All things considered, unless you have a clear reason to believe they're not serving you halal food, you say Bismillah, you eat it, you don't refuse to eat it, and you don't question them about the origin of the meat in a way that is offensive. So you have to navigate that carefully. And this goes, so if you take that more lenient position on meat, you should be mindful of those Muslims who take the stricter view. We respect the khilaf, and as we said last week, if you take the more lenient view, you respect the khilaf of those who take the stricter view. If you take the stricter view, you can respect the khilaf and not criticize or attack the person who takes a more lenient view. But if you have that conviction, then the person who is going to host you should respect that conviction as well, right? So it has to be communicated sensitively, inshallah. So now we come to the question of consumption. We said that this module is about haram consumption. We didn't say haram food, because not everything that is consumed is food or drink. Some things that are consumed that are haram are not food, such as drugs, such as other things. So we get to the issue of drugs. Now, are drugs halal or haram? Or consuming drugs halal or haram? Did any of you take a Tylenol today? Technically, that's a drug. So when we talk about drugs, we have to be very precise in our language, right? So things like marijuana, cannabis, hashish, opium, these things are called narcotics. And in Arabic, you call these things mukhaddirat. Mukhaddirat comes from the word khadr. And khadr means that which is covered. And it refers to a person who is feeling very lazy and languid. So technically, a narcotic is a drug that induces a narcosis-like state or produces narcosis-like symptoms, stupor, insensibility, numbness, drowsiness, and yes, even pain relief. So when we look at the ruling in Islam on a particular substance, a drug, we have to look at the effects of those drugs or the states of being as a whole. What effects does it have on the person? So if the primary effect of that drug is elation, euphoria, delirium, alongside drowsiness and insensibility, then we will call that drug a muskir, an intoxicant. So not all drugs are intoxicants, but all intoxicants are drugs, according to this definition. So a muskir is an intoxicant because it changes one's behavior, it changes one's sense perception, it impairs their judgment and their cognition, their reaction times, and so on and so forth. So when we talk about drugs, we know that lots of drugs have side effects. Some of these side effects they basically induce a kind of narcosis state. If you have a really bad toothache and you have to get it treated, sometimes the dentist will prescribe something like Tylenol 3. Have you ever had Tylenol 3? Anyone? This is the over-the-counter Tylenol. Then there's Tylenol 3, which is, you're not supposed to drive with Tylenol 3 because it induces this narcosis-like state where you're very drowsy and languid and just, your mental faculties are there, but they're reduced, right? It's not like marijuana, but it's still enough to where you can't drive. So you have those kinds of drugs. Then you have drugs like marijuana or cannabis products. And some of these things, if they're mukhaddirat, if they're muskirat, intoxicants, they're haram. If they're used, unless there is a very specific need, right? So many of the ulama, among the Hanafis and the Shafi'is, they will allow for the usage of what is ordinarily an unlawful substance if it is for medicinal purposes, and as long as there is no other halal alternative available. And this is especially the case if there's a clear track record where it is empirically seen as beneficial for that condition. One of the great Shafi'i imams, Imam Badruddin Az-Zarkashi, he wrote an entire book on marijuana, right? Called Zahrul Arish fi Tahrim al-Hashish. It's all about the prohibition of marijuana. And in it, and he's a great Shafi'i authority, he says it is permissible to us to use as a medicine if it is confirmed that it benefits against some illness. If it's confirmed that it benefits, it is permissible to use. Likewise, Imam al-Nawawi, he mentions in Al-Majmu' and Rawdat al-Talibin, he quotes one of the early Shafi'i imams, Imam al-Ruwayani, who says, is permissible to use it for medicine, even if it leads to intoxication, as long as it is necessary. However, if it benefits in terms of medication, then it is permissible to use as medicine, and Allah knows best. This does not mean that a person can say, oh, I have a headache, let me go get that card and I can go buy medical marijuana to get rid of my headache. It's not so simple. There's a whole process involved for even determining whether that would be the only option available that would allow one to consume it. Because otherwise, the default is that any intoxicant is haram. So that's our operative principle. The default is that the muskirat, intoxicants, are haram. The exception would be in those situations where it's medically necessary. And there are conditions for that. One of the conditions is that the need to use them reaches the level of darura, not, oh, I have a headache, let me go get some medical marijuana, or, oh, I have anxiety, let me get some medical marijuana. It doesn't work that way, because you have other means of treating the anxiety, other means of treating the headache and other ailments. It has to be darura. It cannot be used for these small things that can be treated through other means. So if it brings symptomatic relief from chronic pain or severe acute pain, that could be considered a medical necessity, but not things like, you know, simple headaches and anxiety and the like. And it has to be truly beneficial. And that's not left to the person to determine. It has to be determined by specialist doctors in that field who determine based on their expertise that this is the best thing for you to use given your conditions in this specific dosage for this amount of time, and you're taking it out of darura, out of necessity, based on that expert medical opinion. And that expert medical opinion, there's a difference here. Some of the ulama say that expert medical opinion has to come from a Muslim. And I think that's really important, because many doctors will just prescribe it based on talking about your symptoms, whereas a Muslim knows the principle that, well, this is a muskir, it's an intoxicant. So if I am prescribing this to my fellow Muslim, I need to make sure that it truly is a darura, a necessity for their acute pain or condition, and that there are no other alternatives that will treat this issue that are not intoxicant. So these are just some of the conditions. We've had a discussion about this as well in the Ask the Imam session. Someone asked me if it's halal to work in a medical marijuana facility. And this is part of that answer. So generally, muskirat are no different than alcohol. And the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam mentions that every muskir is haram. Everything that intoxicates is haram. And by intoxicate, we mean it impairs one's mental faculties, giving different feelings of elation, euphoria, or lethargy, clouding of the intellect, and so on. And because of this definition, you see how it was applied later by scholars when they tried to determine whether or not coffee is halal or haram, or whether or not tobacco is halal or haram. Because their immediate question was, are these substances intoxicants? What are the effects they produce within the person? Are these effects the same as what hashish or marijuana or opium would produce? Are they intoxicants or not? And we'll get to the issue of smoking right now. So let me ask you, this is Islam is not a democracy here, but with a show of hands, how many of you believe that smoking is haram? With a show of hands. Wow, not as many hands as I thought. How many of you believe that smoking is makruh? Okay, more hands. Okay, now we'll see the brave ones. How many of you believe that smoking is neither haram nor makruh, but you believe it's absolutely halal? And you're a doctor. So there's a lot of interesting history when we look at the issue of smoking and the ruling on smoking, tobacco products, in Islamic law. And we start by saying that tobacco and smoking in general are not explicitly mentioned in the Quran or in the Sunnah, which means there is no nas, there is no explicit scriptural reference mentioning tobacco or smoking. That's important to note, because it means any judgment on it being haram is not taken directly from the Quran or the Sunnah. It is taken via qiyas, right? This analogy where it shares in certain features, certain things that are mentioned explicitly within the Quran and the Sunnah. So for this reason, because there's no explicit mention in the Quran and the Sunnah, the ulama have given different opinions about tobacco and smoking over the centuries. Some said it is mubah, otherwise it's halal. Some say it is makruh, others say it is haram. No one says it's wajib, not to my knowledge, or mustahab. Actually, I take that back. One of them did say, but in a very specific context, as a guest or something, when that's the adah, but that's not even worthy of discussion here. So we're really looking at three possible views. Historically, either it's seen as permissible, or it's makruh, so not haram, or it is prohibited, it's haram, and it's sinful to smoke and use tobacco products. So let's give a little bit of history about tobacco and its introduction into the Muslim world. The earliest fatwa regarding smoking was issued in Morocco in 1602, because tobacco was introduced around that time period by some Europeans. And following the introduction of tobacco to the kingdom in 1598, King Ahmad al-Mansur sought some guidance, some fatwa, from the ulama of Fes, which was the center of the Islamic scholarship in Morocco at the time. And the Grand Mufti of the Kingdom of Morocco and the governor of Sala both ruled, and the both of them ruled that smoking was haram. That was it. And before you're surprised at that, understand that many of the ulama also said that coffee was haram when it was first introduced. And then it changed. There's a really good paper, a historical analysis of the fatwas on coffee and how those things evolved over time. Because qahwa in Arabic, it's a word for wine. So anyhow. So when that fatwa was given, that smoking tobacco is haram, it didn't really have much of an impact. The everyday smokers were not really having that. It didn't have an impact. And so the Mufti issued a second fatwa declaring it to be haram. And he declared it haram, as is the use of all intoxicants and harmful substances. So you see here in the fatwa, he's grouping tobacco with intoxicants and harmful substances, which are haram in Islam. But this categorical tahrim was also unsuccessful. In fact, it was so unsuccessful that those scholars who supported the Mufti's ruling that tobacco was haram were attacked. Some of them were even killed by a mob of angry smokers. And they were forced to flee, and those who survived were forced to flee the country. So this shows you that it was a very touchy subject early on. And many of the early ulama also declared it either haram or makruh, and some mubah, right? And there's rasa'il, there's books written about the issue of smoking very early on when it was introduced into the Muslim world. Now, those who argued that tobacco or smoking is haram, they use a number of evidences. Some of these are taken directly from the Quran or from the hadith. Others are based on principles. So they'll say that smoking or tobacco products are haram because Allah Ta'ala says, do not cast yourselves into ruin. Right? Another verse of the Quran says, لا تقتلوا أنفسكم. Don't kill yourselves. They would say that it's haram because tobacco is not from the طيبات, not from the pure and wholesome things. Therefore, it's from the khaba'ith, and Allah has forbidden the khaba'ith. They say it's haram because tobacco is a waste of money, and Allah Ta'ala prohibits waste. Those who prohibited smoking and tobacco also evoked the principle based on the hadith, لا ضرر ولا ضرار. There is to be no harm or reciprocating harm towards others. And they said it is harmful, and harm is generally prohibited. They would say that secondhand smoke is a harm to others. This is coming later in the discussion when people were learning about secondhand smoke. But even in the early fatwas, some of them would say that it is it creates an annoyance, or it has an offensive odor to people, and therefore you are, in a sense, kind of harming people with that offensive smell. And it is generally, because of the offensive smell, they would group it in the things that are haram. And some of them even said that tobacco was an intoxicant, which is not the case, obviously. It's not it's not a muskir intoxicant. So these are the basic proofs that were used by those ulama who gave rulings that smoking is haram. And when we look at these proofs, we can see that some of them, they're not airtight, right? And this is not my way of getting to a ruling that you should go light up some Marlboro Reds after class. I'm not saying that at all, actually. But I want you to have an understanding of where this conversation, how it has developed over time. And so some of the scholars say that if the reason for the prohibition of tobacco is harm, that's the illah, what about foods and drinks that also cause long-term bodily harm? Right? Would that mean that sugar is haram? Because we have a very robust record of the metabolic conditions that arise due to excess consumption of sugar. Look at type 2 diabetes right now. How many people are affected by that? Right? Does that mean that sugar is haram? Does that mean that seed oils, like sunflower oil, canola oil, which do cause inflammation in the body, are those also haram? Corn syrup, junk food, like all of these things can have some harmful effects on people. So if you say it's prohibited because of harm, why doesn't that apply to other things as well that we consume? So there's a question here, and we're going to actually revisit that question in the last few slides when we look at junk food. One could also argue that sugar is a waste of money, that these things that people eat, junk food, is a waste of money. So if you say that smoking or tobacco is haram because it's a waste of money, how many things do we waste our money on? You bought those Twinkies and those donuts. Surely that's a waste of money, right? The same argument can be used. So it's not really airtight. As for the issue of tobacco and the offensive smell of smoke, that, on the other side, the scholars would say that's not a sufficient reason to say that tobacco or smoking is haram. They say at the most, it would mean that a person who is smoking is not permitted to enter the masjid with that cigarette odor on their person or clothing, because we know that it is not allowed for a person to go into the masjid with after they've eaten onions or garlic or leeks if that odor, this offensive odor to both humans and the angels, are on their body or on their person. So no one says onions are haram. No one says garlic is haram. So you can't say that the offensive odor is enough to judge it as haram. As for the claim that that tobacco is not from the tayyibat, the pure and wholesome things, and that it's from the khaba'ith, or the impure things, this is also questionable, according to the other side, because it's a plant. The plant is pure. You can use the plant for other purposes. It's not najasa, it's not impure. Therefore, it's not the same as maita. It's not the same as a predator or an animal that consumes najasa. We wouldn't call it khabith in and of itself. And as for the claim that it's an intoxicant, then obviously that is false. It doesn't intoxicate. It does create effects in the body, but it's not intoxication. A person's mental faculties are fully there. They're not subdued in any way whatsoever. And those who permitted tobacco say that if an individual is experiencing bodily harm because of it, it would be prohibited for them and them alone. But that applies to anything. Sugar, or anything. If something that you consume is producing verifiable, clear bodily harm to you, the detriment of your life, it would be haram for you to continue consuming that thing, whether it's tobacco or other products. So these are some of the replies to the position of those who prohibited smoking or using tobacco. Now, I'm not a mufti, but you know, my view, personally speaking, is that if you say that tobacco is haram, that is a valid view, and that's an acceptable view. And there are strong arguments in favor of that because of the long-term effects of tobacco, smoking in particular. There's a strong argument to be made that because of the long-term health effects that are not, they're not universal. I mean, it's not an absolute guarantee you're going to destroy yourself, but there's a strong chance because of what we have seen over the centuries. I think it's a strong argument. But does that mean that a person who smokes one cigarette is the same who is smoking two packs a day for 25 years? I don't think you can say the two are the same in this regard. And if you say it's haram in and of itself because of that harm, you have to be consistent and apply that to other substances that also cause harm. And that leads us to a whole conversation about junk food, food additives, harmful things that people are consuming daily, and no one's batting an eyelid over them, right? So again, I'm not a mufti, so I don't give any kind of fatwa saying it's haram, nor do I want to say it's mubah either. But I will say that no one should adopt it, and no one should take up the practice. You know, one of the mashayikh who was talking about the issue of smoking, he was going through the latter day text within the Hanbali school. And the latter Hanabila, the great fuqaha from the Hanbalis, they said it's either permissible or makruh. And he was defending this view on the basis of the fiqh and the usul, meaning the principles by which they arrived at that judgment. And as he's defending that view, he's saying, I don't smoke. I don't defend smoking. You shouldn't smoke. And if you smoke, make a plan to quit smoking. However, this is deen. And if you say something as haram, you are saying that it is sinful in the sight of Allah, and that you are opening yourself up to iqab, to potential punishment in the hereafter over that. That's a heavy judgment. And if it's not mentioned explicitly within the Qur'an or the Sunnah, and the qiyas is really shaky, he's basically saying, I'm not going to speak on this as a religious matter and give a fatwa that it's haram when I'm not convinced that it is. But at the same time, I'm not encouraging it. Just because you look at it from the fiqh and usul and say it's not haram, doesn't mean you're saying, go buy cigarettes and take up the habit of smoking. And as the ulama have stated, those who permitted it also said, if an individual is experiencing verifiable harm to their body, where it's literally causing conditions, it would be haram for them because of that verifiable harm, because of the harm principle. That doesn't mean that's a universal prohibition for every single person. So I'm not going to say it's haram. I'm not going to say it's halal. And if I say it's makruh, it's only because there are ulama who said it's makruh because of this potential, strong potential, of leading to this harm. And to avoid that is praiseworthy. So don't smoke. Don't adopt it. But if you do consume tobacco products and you take that view, it is a valid view. But and this is where you have to be mature, right? Just because you defend a fiqh position and saying it's not haram, that doesn't mean you're encouraging people to adopt that habit. And it could be haram for some people. Wallahu a'lam. So this leads us to the next question. Remember I said the illah, if they say the illah, the ratio legis, the reason for the prohibition, if they say it's because of harm, what about other foods? What about other things we consume that do cause harm, like sugar, like seed oils, like food additives, things that are also, there's also a record of them causing harm? Does that mean that those become prohibited as well? Maybe, maybe not. Let's find out. Is junk food haram or halal? If you think that eating a box of donuts is halal, raise your hand. Halal. A box of donuts, not a box of tobacco. Box of donuts. Okay. If you think that drinking Red Bull is halal, raise your hand. Okay. If you think drinking 20 Red Bulls in one sitting is halal, you see where I'm going with this? Okay. So let's look at junk food. Now, we want to talk about maxims, qawa'id, because we operate on principles. There are several legal maxims, principles, that guide our understanding of food and things we consume. Number one, al-aslu fil ashya' al-ibaha. The default is that things are permissible, excluding, right, meat and intercourse. Those are the two exceptions. That's principle number one. Principle number two, لا ضرر ولا ضرار. There is to be no harm or reciprocating harm, meaning harm towards others. And this is from a hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, found in the Muwatta of Imam Malik. And from it, we have other principles derived, such as الضرار يزال. Harm is to be removed. Right? That's one of the principles of Sharia. It is the removal of harm right? And there's lots of principle or lots of ahkam, rulings that are subsumed under that principle, that maxim. Another principle is that harm is not to be removed by another harm, right? And one bears the minor harm to alleviate the greater harm, right? So something that may hurt or be difficult, it's a kind of darar. You would endure it to remove a greater harm, but you're not going to remove one harm with an equal or worse harm. So these are various maxims that we use to look at these questions of whether this thing is halal or this thing is haram. So the principle governing consumption of things like junk food and tobacco, for that matter, is the level of harm involved in consumption, right? One of the early Shafi'i jurists, he mentions in the Book of Foods, the Kitab al-Ta'am, in the Muhaddab, he says that the pure things are two categories. Notice he's not saying impure things. Pure things are two categories. Pure things that harm and pure things that do not harm. Anything that harms is impermissible to consume, such as poison, earth, and stones. So that clump of dirt outside, is it pure or impure? It's pure. That's the default. Does that mean you can eat it? Why? Because it causes harm, right? That glass bottle broken up outside, is it pure or impure? It's pure. Can you eat glass? No. That rat poison, assuming it's from something pure, it's a pure substance, but you can't drink that rat poison because it causes harm, right? Imam an-Nawawi, he comments on this work, the Muhaddab. He says it's impermissible to eat pure things that cause harm, such as deadly poison, glass, and dirt that causes harm to the body. However, the ulama mention that there are certain foods that, okay, they're pure, but they can cause harm, but it's a relative harm. Relative harm, meaning it would not harm one person, but it would harm another. I'll give you a really good example. You notice how more and more people these days have a severe allergic reaction to peanuts. And nuts in general, if they eat peanuts, sometimes even if they smell peanuts, they go into this anaphylactic shock and they need the EpiPen. It's a huge problem. Now, if I have a jar of peanut butter here and you're not allergic to peanuts, can you eat it? Yeah. Maybe it has sugar, maybe it has whatever. Doesn't matter. It's halal. It's pure. You can eat it. But if you have a severe nut allergy, can you eat that peanut butter? No. If you did it on purpose and you have that severe nut allergy, what exactly are you doing? You're consuming something that is pure and permissible, but it harms you. It harms you. And you have certainty of that because you have this allergic reaction to peanuts. So for you to consume that would be haram. Whereas for another person who doesn't have allergic reactions, it will be halal. So the ulama say that there are certain foods that cause relative harm. Not harm for one person, but harm for another. And this has to be considered. Imam al-Juwayni, one of the great early Shafi'i jurists, he said, were it conceivable that a person could eat poison without it harming him at all, it would not be prohibited for him to eat it since it does not cause him any harm. So there you go. Let's say a person, some reason or the other, can consume poison. Doesn't harm him. Him drinking that rat poison would not be the same as someone else doing it. Just like the person with the allergic reaction to peanut butter eating peanut butter was not the same as one who doesn't have that allergic reaction. Because in origin, both substances are pure. So foods may be permissible in origin, but harmful in certain quantities or in certain combinations. And because of that, for that person, they could be haram, right? So we could say that peanut butter for that person would be prohibited if they know it's going to cause this great harm to themselves. So what about junk food? What about those boxes of donuts and those Twinkies and cookies and those nice things that we have here and elsewhere in our houses? Well, obviously we cannot group junk food with glass or dirt or rat poison, because those things are immediately harmful. As soon as you eat them, you're harming yourself. It's very clear. Because the harmful effects of junk food are not always universal, and they are most often cumulative, meaning they doesn't happen overnight. There's many years often before the effects of them manifest within a person. And even then, it's not certain. You know, they did studies on octogenarians, those who live to 100 and beyond, and they asked them, what are the secrets to living to your hundreds? And, you know, one lady in France, she said, well, I eat a pound of chocolate every single week, and I make sure to drink my brandy and smoke my one pack of cigarettes. So this is a clear case of correlation, not implying causation. That doesn't mean that you're going to live to 100 if you take those things. Someone else could eat a pound of chocolate a week and they get diabetes, right? Or they get lung cancer from smoking, or liver damage from the alcohol. So that's haram anyway. So that's something to consider. Another thing is that almost any food, if taken to excess, can cause bodily harm. But that does not change the default ruling on that food. Honey is halal. But if you eat 20 pounds of honey in one go, I'm sure you're going to be in a lot of pain. Sugar is halal. But if you consume it to a certain amount, there's a chance you could get diabetes, right? So it all depends. This means that there is no one single ruling on junk food. We don't say, oh, junk food is just, it's not natural, it's not good, therefore haram. Or, you know, I'm a health nut, I like to eat healthy, therefore. This is not how we talk about Sharia. So the closest rulings that the ulama have given for junk food is the following. They say, if it is consumed in a form or an amount that will cause certain harm, yaqeen, then it's haram. But that has to be certain. It can't be based on speculation. So for example, if you have one Red Bull, you're fine. You have two Red Bulls, you're feeling the effects of it, too much caffeine. If you drink 20, you may have a heart attack, right? There, obviously, the poison here is in the dosage. If a person was to consume such an amount that it's going to cause verifiable harm, it would be haram for them to do that, not because the substance itself is haram in essence, but because of the amount they're taking, right? If it is consumed occasionally and in amounts that do not normally harm, it's permissible. So go eat the cheesecake, eat the ice cream, eat the box of donuts. Maybe it's not the best thing for you. Maybe it's going to cause some weight gain, right? But if it's occasionally, you know, you have your cheap meal, your cheap whatever, you have it from time to time and there's no verifiable harm, it's halal. But if it is consumed so regularly in such a manner that it is known to cause harm, but it's not certain to what extent or how long, but you're consuming it such an amount that customarily this is going to bring you into type 2 diabetes territory, then the ulama would say it's makruh. Some say, some of the Hanafis would say, makruh tahrimi in some cases, where it's prohibitively disliked. Others would say it's disliked in a general sense. So there's no one single ruling on eating cupcakes and donuts and cakes and pies and all of that. But if you know you have type 2 diabetes, or you have pre-diabetes, for example, and you know that you're eating too much of this stuff, and that if you don't stop or severely curtail your consumption of these products, you're going to end up being diabetic and causing harm. Well, for you to continue, you're either doing something makruh, or you're either doing something that is haram of a minor level, makruh tahrimi, compared to, we wouldn't say haram in the Hanafi sense, because that's something that is very textually stipulated. So there's no one size fits all ruling for these kinds of things. And yeah, that's the gist of the rulings on matters of junk food. And these are relevant questions, you know, because in some parts of the world, they have products that do cause very, very clear harm. Have you ever heard of Saudi champagne? Saudi champagne. You know, you've heard about it? So Saudi champagne, I was shocked when I heard what this stuff is. They drink it at parties. It is, you take a pitcher, and you pour lots of Red Bull. You pour in, after the Red Bull, you pour in, you know, that thick mango juice or that thick pear juice. It's all sugar. And then you're adding sugar to that. And then you're adding chopped up mango to that and putting it inside. And you stir it all together and you drink this. Sugar on sugar on sugar. Just leading you to diabetic shock. You know, so the ulama were asked, what is the ruling on this Saudi champagne? Right? And they said, given the way it's prepared and what it leads people to and the rate of diabetes increasing in that region, we have to say it's either makruh or haram depending on the person and what it leads to. Right? Not because those individual things are haram in themselves, but because of the amount that they're taking in and the verifiable harm it's wreaking in their bodies. So we have to be mindful of these things because the body is a trust. And just because a thing is halal doesn't mean that we can eat it in unlimited amounts, even if it causes us clear bodily harm. So this is the conclusion, inshallah, to the module on the halal and haram concerning food matters. And yeah, we're actually out of time, aren't we? Yeah, maybe we'll do that. We'll allocate a whole session for questions. I got about 10 questions so far, just from last week's. So we can address those questions and you can send them to me either directly or you could email me, imam@mccgp.org. And I'll get those questions and we'll try to gather them and address them, inshallah ta'ala. Wallahu rasulu a'lam wa sallallahu wa sallam ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam.